Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Conser, and today I'll be taking you back to August of 2021, when I was joined by graphic novelist Derf Backderf. He's the author of the books My Friend Dahmer, Punk Rock and Trailer Parks, Trashed, and the Eisner Award-winning Kent State, Four Dead in Ohio. His alternative comic, The City, ran in over 75 weekly newspapers for 25 years. And his book, My Friend Dahmer, was adapted into a feature film in 2017. The publication of Derf's book, Kent State, had been scheduled as part of a 50th anniversary commemoration of the 1970 Kent State massacre. As we'll hear in the conversation, the COVID pandemic shutdown complicated things. And now, Derf, recorded on August 20th, 2021. Derf Backderf, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the Eisner Award for Kent State.
Thanks. That was a big thrill.
Well, this is a doorstop of a book. It's 280 pages.
It is. It's a heavy book.
And the last 25 or 30 of those pages are all research notes. I mean, you really put in the time on this project.
Yeah, I did. Four years total. And the first 2 years were spent just, you know, digging through the archives and doing research.
Well, I've read a number of articles over the years about the May 4th, 1970 massacre at Kent State University. I mean, Kent State is just synonymous with what happened that day. And it's such an absurd and senseless incident. But still, until I read the book all the way through, I didn't know a fraction of the story.
Well, it's good to hear. That means I did my job. It's a surprisingly complicated story because it's really the bloody climax of about 7 or 8 years of civil unrest in this country and all of these forces that were roiling the nation in the 60s all came crashing together, perhaps inexplicably, at Kent State University. So, you know, you have to work in some backstory, you have to work in some context, but I really strove to tell a very tight, suspenseful narrative. And despite being, what did you call it, a doorstop? I think it's a pretty intense read. I mean, it goes fast and it's a page turner. So, because a great story, I mean, it's just a fabulous story.
Well, let's start with the personal angle because that's the way the book begins. Mm-hmm. You grew up in the town of Richfield, Ohio, about 20 miles west of Kent.
Correct.
And you show yourself with your folks reading Mad Magazine. Were you already a comics artist back in grade school or just a comics aficionado?
Oh, yeah, I was drawing. I have some political cartoons I drew at age 10. So I was kind of a prodigy. Then I stalled, of course, when I, you know, it's a certain point. But I got off to a fast start. No, I grew up there. So I've always had this connection to the massacre because, you know, I witnessed part of it. I mean, this is not my story. I'm not of that generation. You know, I came of age in 1980, not 1970. And the world had changed by then. And I didn't go to Kent. So, I'm kind of an outsider. But when you grow up in that area, Kent State Massacre, it's part of your DNA. I mean, everybody knows about it. Everybody knows somebody who was there. People are connected to it in unusual ways. So, for all those reasons, and because the Guard was in my town, they were sent in just before the incident at Kent State.
Right. It was only a few days earlier.
Right.
And you were, you show yourself in the car with your mom driving past these National Guard troops standing up against striking truckers.
Right. Right. And it's, you know, it's when you're that age, I mean, to have the military invade and occupy your hometown is a little, it's a little disconcerting, you know what I mean? It kind of felt at that moment that the entire world was just rushing in, you know, with these troops. Because up until that point, it had just been an abstract. You know, these things had happened. There was the Vietnam War going on. But as far as I was concerned, the Vietnam War was always going on. I don't remember a time when it wasn't. And campuses were in flames and streets were, you know, there were street battles everywhere. But again, I don't remember a time when that wasn't the case. But when the soldiers came in and they're literally lining the streets of this little town I lived in, and facing off against, you know, these Teamsters who were my neighbors. They were the parents, you know, the fathers of my schoolmates. It really screwed up my head. So yeah, that's why it really has stuck with me all these years.
Well, we already know the outcome of the story going in. It's right there in the title, Four Dead in Ohio. And the choice you make is not just to bring these four students to life for the reader, but you're trying to bring the whole campus, the whole town to life, the way it was in May of 1970.
That's right. Yeah. And that was not an easy task. I mean, that's why it took so long to research, because, you know, it's a very small window and nothing changes faster than a university and a college town. I mean, it's just constant change. So I had to hit this very tiny window and figure out what was where and what buildings were there and what were not. And, you know, I mean, it took a long time, and then track down the visual reference for those things, which was not easy as well. So it was a lot of detective work, which I kind of enjoy, but it was very challenging. And then on top of it, I had to figure out what happened. And, you know, it's all kind of cloaked in lies and misdirection and misinformation, much as what we're seeing now, say with, you know, the January 6th insurrection. It's just all this misinformation, and, you know, people have different points of view, and there's a bunch of, you know, just outright lies and conspiracy theories. Same thing in 1970. It's really shocking how little we have advanced as a culture in 50 years. I mean, it's just the same stuff repeating.
Well, the way you tell this story, I mean, it's nonfiction, of course, but Right. It's weirdly cinematic. The way that all these pieces Sure. fall into place one by one in the lead up to May of 1970. You got the town gown conflicts in Kent, the arrest the year before of the SDS leaders on campus, mm-hmm. The infiltration of student groups by FBI provocateurs. Yeah, there's a trigger happy governor sending the National Guard all over the state. And then finally, Nixon escalates the Vietnam War into Cambodia.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, it was all these great forces, you know, leading inexorably to May 4. But the story itself, the way I choose to tell this story, it's not as this big, you know, sweeping history. What I'm doing is focusing on the four kids who were killed, Allison, Sandy, Jeff, and Bill. And if you'll notice in the book, I tell the story almost entirely through their eyes and through their experiences. And one of them was present at everything that happened that weekend. It was 4 days of escalating tension leading to Monday, May 4. So the reader is actually right there on the ground with them and walking through this scene and this story right next to them. And I think that makes it very personal and emotional, because that's, you know, this is where you find the humanity in the stories with these people. And when they're cut down, it's a gut punch. And so the great sweeping stuff is kind of, it's in the background, and I try to work it in as we move along. But the focus is really on those four.
And, you know, I think to this day, a lot of people think that the four students who were shot dead and the nine others who were injured were all hardcore radical activists.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, that's the furthest thing from the truth. One of the four that was killed was Bill Schroeder, a military trainee. He was an ROTC cadet on campus.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. About half the kids who were shot were not protesting at all. The important point here is that the university was still open because the governor refused to close it, because that would be quote unquote giving in to the radicals. And there were a couple protests in the days before. There was some window smashing downtown to protest Nixon's invasion of Cambodia. What merchants in Kent had to do with that, I don't know. But these things kind of get out of hand. I think beer was involved. And then the following day, the ROTC building was torched. A group of students did finally set fire to this wooden ROTC building and burned it to the ground. So there was some escalating tension, but the governor refused to close the university. 21,000 students on that campus who were moving about during their day while the National Guard suddenly swept through the middle of them, and at one point inexplicably turned and opened fire into a parking lot full of students, most of whom had books in their hands, and fired, you know, 67 shots over 13 seconds. 4 dead, 9 wounded, 9 shot and wounded.
I think what's fascinating, okay, one of the things you emphasize is just the escalating tension in those 4 days.
It's like a runaway train.
Yeah. After Nixon announces the troops are going into Cambodia. And then one of the threads that you follow is the members of the Black United Students. Mm-hmm. They're watching these developments unfold. And when they discuss the situation, they say, you know, as important as these protests are, we have to start laying low right now, because if we get out in front, we're going to be the ones who are the targets. Right. And I mean, this is something that's relevant even half a century later.
Sure is. But back then, the previous 3 years, the governor of Ohio had sent in the National Guard into African-American neighborhoods in almost every big city in the state to crush some uprising or protest or another. So these kids, most of whom were from Cleveland, inner city Cleveland, and the Guard had been sent in twice in very bloody crackdowns in that city. These kids, they grew up with this stuff. I mean, they knew what it meant when the Guard came in. They knew that those guns were loaded. They knew people were going to get bayoneted. They knew people could well be shot, because they had already experienced that, where the white kids, who were, of course, the overwhelming majority at Kent, I think the African-American population in 1970 was about 2%. So you're talking about 400 or 500 African-American kids in the university. The rest of the 21,000 were white. Those white kids had no experience whatsoever with the Guard. And they just couldn't comprehend that they would ever be in danger or of being shot. In fact, when the Guard started shooting, very commonly, most of the kids thought they were firing blanks. In fact, some of them yelled out, "Don't worry, they're just blanks," as bullets were bouncing off the pavement around them. So it is really kind of the, if you want to pick the day, May 4, 1970 is kind of the end of white naivete when it comes to, you know, protesting the government.
I'm S.W. Conser, and you're listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, featuring graphic novelist Durf Backderf. He's the author of the books My Friend Dahmer and the Eisner Award-winning Kent State, 4 Dead in Ohio.
Tin soldiers and Nixon's coming, we're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming, 4 Dead in Ohio, 4 Dead in Ohio.
So, Kent State, 4 Dead in Ohio is definitely your most serious work.
My Friend Dahmer wasn't exactly a laugh riot, but okay.
Well, you know, most of your other books have some level of levity and absurdity. Even My Friend Dahmer has wacky moments that break up the darkness.
Yeah, a little bit. Right. Yeah, no, Kent is, it's a tragedy. I mean, there's not a lot of joking in Kent State.
So the whole 50th anniversary of Kent State was right in the middle of the COVID shutdown. So everything got pushed back a year.
It just got pushed into the dustbin, really. Yeah, it was going to be this huge event. It was like covering a whole week. It had all these things happening, you know, on campus, and there were probably going to be 15,000-20,000 people coming in for the event, and everybody was really looking forward to it, and it just got wiped out. I mean, just in the space of like a week. And I felt so bad for the students of 1970, because they had waited so long you know, for some confirmation, just some, you know, word from the university that, okay, you guys exist. And this thing happened, and we are embracing this history, because for decades, the university just tried to erase it, to the point of like building things on top of the site because they just wanted to cover it up. And now the shooting site is, that whole site is a national historical site, but that was not the case 20 years ago, say. But for the 50th, this was finally going to be their moment, and it was taken away from them. And I just feel terrible for them because, you know, it's not, not to be morbid, but these guys are all in their 70s now. And we've lost a lot of them. And we just, since the 50th, we've lost a few more, including some of the shooting victims. You know, not many of them are going to be around for the 60th, you know, and they love those nice round numbers. So that's just something that was lost and probably won't be repeated. It's just so bad. It's just too bad.
There was also, a big influence on culture. And I know that you've been a punk rock and new wave fan since it was all underground scenes. You mentioned Devo, Jerry Casale, Mark Mothersbaugh, Bob Lewis were all Kent State students at the time.
So was Bob Mothersbaugh, I think. Yeah. Bobs and Jerry were both in the line of fire.
Yeah, Jerry Casale, he was friends with I think both Allison and Jeff who were killed. He was out there right on the scene.
Right. Yeah. There was more too. I mean, Joe Walsh was on that hill, believe it or not.
Wow.
And Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders. She was a freshman that year and heard the gunfire as she was walking to class. So yeah, Kent was this incredible music and arts hotbed, still is to some degree.
Well, I know this had a huge influence on Devo, you know, the band that formed with Casale and Mothersbaugh and Lewis and others, but they started out with an emphasis on art as confrontation, and their concept of human de-evolution kind of grew out of that.
Yeah, I remember those early shows. Yeah, they were more performance art than music. And then later they discovered that they could actually write really catchy songs and took off from there. But early on, they were really kind of a performance troupe, really underground performance troupe. Got a lot of groans whenever they showed up to perform too. The Kent State student body was not exactly embracing them. There's one great, I wish I'd gone, but I was too young when, the John Waters film, the first one, what was it Pink Flamingos?
Well, that was his first big feature, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When that premiered in Kent, Devo opened for the screening. Now, how would you like to be at that show?
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, I was too young, but.
Let's talk about Terry Norman. He may be the most fascinating character in this story, in the same way that Satan is the most fascinating character in Paradise Lost.
Yeah, he's an interesting cat. He was a radical right-wing student who was a law enforcement major. They had a very large law enforcement school at Kent State. And actually, there were probably more radical right students at Kent State in 1970 than there were radical left. So he was one of them. And he had already run a couple undercover operations for the FBI. He was trying to become an agent and had been on a couple of missions for them. And he was working for the FBI on May 4. But he was kind of a bit of a train wreck, very reckless, arrogant, confrontational. Everybody on campus knew he was a narc. So, you know, what kind of undercover agent is that, right? If everybody knows who he is. And he was galloping through the middle of this protest with a guard on one side and a group of about 400, maybe, at which declined in number as the operation went on, of protesters on the other side, just defiantly holding an anti-war protest on the college green because the guard had outlawed it. And they said, oh, well, screw you. We're going to have it anyways. And so Norman is running around in the middle of this. He's armed.
He has concealed weapon.
He has a pistol on him. And it was, it's just really, to me, it represents the recklessness of the authorities on that day. There were five or six law enforcement entities on campus that day, none of them communicating with each other. The guard itself was just a disaster. I mean, the generals were just boobs. And it's just this cascading torrent of incompetence and bad decisions over and over and over again over the course of not just May 4, but just specifically on May 4, but the previous 2 days as well, that led to this tragedy. It's tragedy by incompetence, really. And Norman really represents that in a lot of ways. But yeah, he's an interesting dude. Still around.
Yeah. He's still alive and people have not forgotten him. If I'm not mistaken, he ended up serving a few years in prison for major fraud.
Yeah, he did. He embezzlement. He tried to flee the country. And I can't remember off the top of my head how many years he served, maybe three. And now he's lived out of the public eye ever since and won't talk to anybody and has never talked to anybody. And the last journalist that tried to interview him was a colleague of mine. Terry came running out the end of the driveway and pulled a gun and stuck it in his face. So I don't think you really want to antagonize the guy because he wants to be left alone. Whatever secrets he has, he's going to keep them. Which is fairly common on that side of the conflict. Most of the people who did the shooting, and Norman didn't do any shooting, but most of the people who did the shooting have not talked and probably never will.
Well, that's part of the controversy. And I mean, the whole scene was chaotic and you portray it very carefully in the book. Right. But
that's what my art form can do. You know, I mean, I can add visual clarity to something in a way that other forms of storytelling cannot.
Well, your comics, especially your early work, it often gets the reputation of being acerbic. But for a lot of people, your most popular short comic was your tribute to Mr. Rogers right after he died. You tell a personal story about when you were living in Pittsburgh and going to art school.
I do, yeah. And I was late getting to class. The place where we lived was some dorms that were maybe a mile away from the art school downtown. I was late getting to class, and believe it or not, they would mark you down if you were tardy to this art school, which is one of the many reasons I left this art school after only a couple semesters. So I missed the bus, and I needed to get there, so I stuck out my thumb, and who pulled over and picked me up but Fred Rogers. And it was one of the most truly surreal moments of my life. And considering that, you know, I grew up with Jeff Dahmer, I mean, my bar for surrealism is fairly high, but that one was really up there. And delightful man, you know, I mean, to get a ride with Mr. Rogers is, it's unique.
Yeah, I mean, he was the real deal. He wasn't like one of those kids show hosts that turns into a gruff character after the cameras are off.
No, he was exactly like he was on TV, which made it even weirder. You know, I mean, we're driving into Pittsburgh and, you know, it's snowing a little bit. He's going, oh, it's snowing today. I like it when it snows, don't you? And I'm just staring at him, you know, with my mouth hanging open. So, yeah. It only, you know, it was a 10-minute drive, but it was an amazing experience.
It really, really changed the tone of the day for you.
Yeah, it did. The whole experience. That was the highlight of my whole time in Pittsburgh, which, for the most part, was fairly unhappy.
Well, you mentioned Jeffrey Dahmer. So tell us a bit about my friend Dahmer. You not only were a classmate of his, but you and your high school buddies actually formed a Jeffrey Dahmer fan club.
Yeah.
The purpose of which was to disrupt polite society.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, we were always kind of looking to do that. You know, we were a bunch of band nerds and AP geeks, and we were bored out of our minds and, you know, in this small town and looking to just get through the day. And Dahmer was always peripherally part of our circle because he was kind of the same type. And in high school, his behavior began to get more and more bizarre. He had this whole shtick where he would pretend to have epileptic fits, and he pretended to have cerebral palsy for a while. I know that, and believe me, I know this all sounds appalling, and it was. But, you know, we're 15. I mean, we're 15-year-old boys. We're idiots. And we found this fascinating. And so we pulled him into our group and really encouraged him to act up in inappropriate places like the library or the cafeteria or wherever. And he enjoyed it. I mean, he loved it. And, you know, looking back on it, of course, I mean, 13 years later, the news breaks that he has killed 17 people and did what he did to those victims. And with a snap of a finger, that entire personal history was rewritten and now has this very chilling, dark meaning to all of these, you know, these goofball antics. Suddenly they become, holy crap. You know, that's what he was thinking when we were doing this stuff. So that's really what the book is about, this spiral of this kid into madness, mostly while the adult world looked on and did nothing. And it's a very troubling book that I think really leaves people with a lot to think about.
Yeah, well, in the book and in the movie that was adapted from your book, Dahmer is just steadily, his actions, his attitudes are just getting steadily darker,
right,
throughout the high school years.
Mm-hmm. Particularly high school, yeah. The last 2 years, really from 10th grade on, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, he got darker, darker, darker. And in 12th grade, I mean, he was just about completely gone. And they just kept pushing him along. You know, they didn't want to be bothered. It still makes me mad, honestly. It's like, if just one person, just one adult had said, whoa, wait a minute, this kid is really out of control, maybe that would have made a difference. So that's really what the book's about.
You've been listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in August of 2021, and featuring graphic novelist Durf Backderf. He's the author of the books My Friend Dahmer, Punk Rock and Trailer Parks, Trashed, and the Eisner Award-winning Kent State, Four Dead in Ohio. His work can be found at the website derfcity.com. That's derfcity.com. I'm SW Conser. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.